Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Mark Galliotti, an analyst of Russian politics who is an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London. He's also the author of the podcast In Moscow's Shadows, as well as We Need to Talk About Putin and several other books about Russia. Mark, thanks very much for joining me today.
Oh, great to be breaking new ground.
All right. Branching out a little bit with guests from outside of RFERL. So thanks very much. I've long wanted to have Mark as a guest. This is a good time for it because he's currently on a trip to Russia that I believe has taken him to Tula in addition to Moscow. We're going to talk about climate change and the tense situation in and around the Donbass in Ukraine. But first, I want to ask Mark about some of his impressions from this visit to Russia. And I would include in that the coronavirus crisis, which has really deepened with a spike in COVID-19 cases and deaths in recent weeks. Now, a nationwide non-working week, paid vacation decreed by President Vladimir Putin has begun, and Moscow is in maybe its tightest lockdown, though not formally called a lockdown, since the start of the pandemic early in 2020. Mark, apologies if this is amorphous, but could you describe some of your main impressions from Moscow, Tula, whatever you like, really?
Sure. Well, obviously, I'll try not to then spend the next 3 hours talking your heads off. If we start with COVID, and it's worth saying, I mean, this is not actually the sort of tightest lockdown, certainly in Moscow. Okay. There was a period where people were pretty much attempted to be anyway banned from going far from their homes and that kind of thing. This is much more of a lockdown light. And in some ways, I mean, that reflects the fact that, yeah, there doesn't seem to be a great sense of emergency about it. I mean, you know, we had this record high levels of cases and deaths. We have the various sort of medical specialists becoming increasingly obviously exasperated and even irate. But on the whole, you know, again, there isn't much vaccine take up. And there's a limit to what the government's willing to do about it. And that's really very striking. I mean, it's clear that not only do they not have the money or are not willing to spend the money on sort of furlough schemes and similar support measures, you know, these non-working days are essentially the burden is on the employer rather than anything else. Right. But more importantly, there really isn't the kind of willingness to alienate the population. There is this sense that now everything is about 2024 and the presidential elections. In some ways, the Duma elections were a kind of nationwide focus group to get into a sense of where they stand, which is not very well. And, you know, essentially, it's therefore about trying to sort of do what they can without actually annoying people. And thus, we have this quite kind of libertarian approach, which is more or less, look, there's lots of vaccines, there's lots of guidance, there's lots of advice. We tell you to put masks on or whatever. If you want to ignore it and put yourself in harm's way, knock yourself out. So it's an interesting, much, much more kind of low-key sense. And you don't actually, walking around the city, feel that there is a great kind of pandemic. I mean, yes, there's mask laws in shops and on public transport and about maybe, if we're generous, 50-50 usage. But that's about it. So that's one thing. Two other things very quickly. I mean, again, talking about mood, I was struck. I was expecting the sort of liberal intelligentsia types who were kind of a natural constituency to be meeting here to be actually much, much more downbeat and negative. And I'm not saying that they're happy with the status quo. It's just in some ways it's interesting that, you know, there were concern about foreign agents law. It was in some ways succeeded by the Zuyev case, this rector of very liberal, the Shaninka, this very liberal Moscow university,
right,
who was caught up in an embezzlement case. More recently, we had the rather surreal case of Rashkin, the Moscow communist boss, sort of, and a thorn in the Kremlin side, being sort of caught with a half-skinned elk in his trunk of his car. And in some ways, I think what's really interesting is that it's almost as if actually the very drumbeat of cases examples of authoritarianism and repression almost has a numbing effect. that it's almost like, these things happen, but life goes on, which is interesting. And the last point I'd make is, Tula. I went because I always like to get out of Moscow to get a sense of the country. And incidentally, Tula, lovely city. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting is that, it is going through a certain process of development of its own. One can see that there's construction, there's modernization and such like. Still, obviously, nothing like the kind of resources that get thrown into Moscow. But first of all, there clearly is a sense of local civic pride. And a sense, and I think this is actually much broader than just Tula, that they develop despite, not thanks to central government. Very definite sense that we're having to do this ourselves. And in that respect, while I was there, the big news was that there was a delegation had gone to Turkey to talk about improved trade links and such like. And at the same time, there was talks going on between Tula and the Moscow city authorities, not the Kremlin, but the city authorities,
right,
precisely about transport links. And it really reminded me of the fact that this huge country, cities and regions, in effect, have their own foreign policies with other cities and regions. We have a tendency to focus very much on what the Kremlin is doing. But in fact, the amount of activity that takes place on an inter-regional, inter-governor, and so forth level, as well as these countries and sort of mini countries speaking out to other nations abroad, that's actually a sort of a dimension that I certainly want to look at more. And I do think because we tend to underplay it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm struck by your comment about the kind of the drumbeat of cases, I guess becoming sort of almost background noise in a way. It sounds like something that, I guess in one sense, it creates, as you say, a numbing effect. And it seems interesting. I was wondering also, did you notice any difference between, I guess you were in Tula before the non-working week started, but did you notice much of a difference between Moscow and Tula, in terms of the COVID, the attitude or the mood or the, what's happening related to COVID?
Yeah, very much. Again, it's interesting. While I was there, in fact, Tula itself brought in advance of national or indeed Moscow regulations, they brought in the sort of requirements that to go into museums and similar sites, you had to show a QR code. And although I have been double vaccinated, I have not been double vaccinated with Russian vaccines. And therefore, in any case, I'm not eligible to get one of these QR codes. And it's not that Tula is actually in a particularly bad shape. It's not one of these places like Khakassia, which is essentially almost, I hesitate to call it martial law, but brought in very, very draconian regulations precisely because of the scale of the problem. It's more just, again, reflects the fact that Putin has, to a large extent, abdicated responsibility. There isn't a clear sort of detailed and granular central policy. And therefore, there is a lot of scope for the regions. And in some cases, regions are going to act in a more aggressive way towards the pandemic, and in others, less so. And in Tula's case, as it has in the past, through the course of the pandemic, they chose to, shall I say, early movers rather than anything else. So again, it shows something about the degree to which this is a very, very disparate country.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you also mentioned the the fact that the Kremlin, Putin, doesn't really want to aggravate anyone too much. Now and even going closer to 2024, and it struck me that Putin, his attitude does seem to have changed. In that, at first he was saying, well, it's a personal choice, vaccination, and then lately he's been, obviously it's not mandatory, but now his explanation is, well, I don't understand, he said the other day. I don't understand what's happening. These people I know, smart people, educated people, are not getting the vaccine. He's kind of, I think he's sort of sloughed off the I guess the blame, onto the people themselves in terms of, well, it's still your choice, but I don't understand what you're doing. So, I find that interesting.
It is a very brief point on that. I mean, again, it's interesting. We have a tendency to think of, Kremlin and the Russian people. But what this really brings up is, although there clearly doesn't seem to be any sort of mass desire for, shall we say, a central policy, the all-important regional elites, who are actually the people who are having to manage this policy and to find the money to pay for it, because, it's all very well sort of basically saying regions should drive policy to reflect local circumstances. But, they can't just simply say, well, fair enough, and our local circumstances are that we need to be paying people to stay home, and therefore we need to have more money from the central sort of treasury as a result. And I think that's where actually there is a level. You can see reading between the lines. I mean, again, no governor is going to come out and actually complain about Putin. But reading between the lines, I mean, there is a degree of tension there. Mm-hmm. There is a sense of, shall we say, the not the foot soldiers, but let's say the sort of the regional boyars,
right.
That definitely at the moment they are in a bad spot. And that's simply because Putin does not want to be the bad guy here.
Absolutely. Very interesting. Okay, let's talk a bit about climate change and what has been, I guess, something of an about face on the issue, or at least on signaling about the issue of climate change on Putin's part. Back in 2003, I believe, he said a few degrees of warming would save Russians money on fur coats. And much more recently, and I guess more seriously, in 2018, I think, he was still questioning the human-caused nature of climate change. But this past June, he changed his tone, he's in remarks at the Valdai Club meeting last month that were, I mean, at least in my view, more notable for what could charitably be called controversial or provocative remarks about gender identity. He spoke in a serious tone about climate change. Now, Putin is not attending the climate summit that started in Glasgow yesterday in person. And Moscow's dedication to real action is a matter of debate. But Putin did pledge last month that Russia will strive to be carbon neutral by 2060, meaning that Russia would absorb as much carbon as it emits, kind of a net zero. I think that's called the same thing. But U.S. President Joe Biden at the G20 summit, yesterday that preceded the climate change meetings, said that Russia and China, quote, basically didn't show up in terms of any commitments to deal with climate change, unquote. So, Mark, I guess a simple question that may not have a very simple answer. Is the Russian change of heart for real? And if so, what has caused it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is real. And in some ways, I think it's a little bit ungenerous because he definitely is late to the party. So he can't necessarily expect it to have many commitments. But they are, for example, sending a very substantial delegation to COP26. I think the reason why, and I mean, you have to realize that he may have internalized the idea, but I'm not quite sure how well he understands it. I mean, he was just saying that, in fact, Russia's forests are going to be much more effective than any sort of obvious sort of green measures, which really is not the case. There's actually a good Felix Light piece in the Moscow Times on this. So, limited understanding. But I think the thing is, this is in some ways a case study for how Putin's views are shaped. He is not intellectually dominant in the sense often of coming up with the ideas, it's who managed to persuade him. And I think what we've seen is in recent times a series of powerful political blocs close to Putin themselves shifting their positions. I mean, particularly, for example, we have the military, not least because they're alarmed at realizing the extent to which so much of their military infrastructure in the high north is actually sitting on permafrost and they don't want to see it sinking into the ice. We have the agricultural lobby. Again, once there was this notion that, Siberia will warm up and it'll be this wonderful new area for farming.
Right.
Well, there just isn't the infrastructure for moving harvests from there. But more to the point, actually, more quickly than that, they would find that their existing farmlands, many of them they would lose to desertification or just general becoming arid. You have politician entrepreneurs like German Gref of Speer and Antonio Weiss of Rosnano, who have identified this actually as a potential money-making venture presumably for themselves, but also for Russia as a whole. And so, you know, I think what we do find is that, again, you know, there are interests in now done. And, you know, it's also worth noting the extent to which you have individual politics coming in. I mean, you know, the particular example would be a couple of weeks ago, I was at the UK ambassador's residence here. And, you know, I think one does have to actually recognize that Ambassador Deborah Bronnett, British ambassador, and her team have done a, frankly, exemplary job of not easing up with Russia on issues of contention, but nonetheless working in areas where cooperation is just possible but necessary. And at this event, the guest speaker was Ruslan Edelgiriev, the Chechen ex-cop and ex-prime minister, who is now the presidential envoy on climate change, you know, who again seems personally and genuinely committed to, you know, actually really grappling with this agenda. So, you know, I think you put all this together, and essentially it's the same sort of transition as in a way has happened in other countries, which is moving climate change away from just being something about saving bunny rabbits and pleasing scientists, and actually addressing very, very hard-edged issues of security and economic power. And that's the kind of language, shall we say, that Putin does respond to. So, you know, again, it's a pragmatic one. It's a delayed one. And I'm not quite sure how well, you know, an understanding that climate change is important combines with a real understanding of the kind of hard, tough moves which are going to be needed to deal with it. But nonetheless, for all that, I think we have to say that this is a genuine conversion.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You mentioned how serious going to be and will the measures be taken? And I think you spoke about Putin's statement that I believe he said forests, you know, Russia's forests can absorb 2.5 or 3 billion. I don't remember the figures, but essentially it was an amount that was, you know, much larger in terms of absorbing carbon than I think others have indicated Russia's forests were capable of doing, and that maybe I think separate measures would have to be taken in order to at least make that have a chance of being possible. So as I think you indicate, you know, kind of a question about what measures will really be taken, but sounds like a genuine, I guess, change of heart, change of policy, based on various, you know, pressure groups, and, you know, maybe also the idea that it's something that he feels he can engage a bit more with, you know, with the West on, perhaps.
Well, that's certainly the idea. But again, I think this is the problem. I think, you know, ultimately, he's still at that point of hoping to find cheap and easy solutions, hence right. This dependence on forests. Not least, it's worth mentioning that considering the terrible scourge at the moment of forest fires, which actually not only consume forests, but also put out a huge amount of carbon. So actually, you know, thinking you can rely on the forests to somehow do the job is naive at best. So, yeah, I mean, again, I think this is it. It's the start of the process. And I think one of the things, you know, if we're looking forward, you know, when we see this big delegation has gone to the COP summit, and OK, it's not Putin, but then again, you know, in these pandemic eras, he basically doesn't travel. Is this an attempt, you might say, to use quantity instead of quality? To you, which is simply say, well, we sent loads of people there, which is right. All very well, but what are they actually going to do? And I think this is it. We haven't had any real signaling of what they might be saying or doing at the summit. And so I think this is going to be the real challenge for the moment, is actually, are they just going as tourists and as spectators, or are we actually going to hear something?
Right. And so far from what Biden said, it sounds like at least the U.S. is you know, is thinking maybe the former. And yeah, good to, thanks for mentioning the forest fires. I think one of the things I read that, you know, would have to be done to make higher kind of absorption numbers realistic would be to actually do more about forest fires, wildfires. So that's a huge obstacle, it sounds like. All right. Now let's move on. There's a lot going on in and around Russia. But the one other issue I'd like to discuss is the heightened tension in and around the Donbass in eastern Ukraine, where more than 13,000 people have been killed since 2014, and the conflict between Kiev and Russia-backed forces continues. Some of the ingredients in the current tension or the current increase in tension are Russian troop movements and signs of a buildup near the Ukrainian border, the use by Ukrainian forces of a Turkish-made drone, I think that was last week, and a shift and sharpening of Russia's rhetoric on Ukraine in general. This has come from Putin, Dmitry Medvedev, Sergei Lavrov, and others. And some analysts who are known not to be alarmist about this issue are saying the situation must be watched closely in the coming days and weeks. Mark, what's your take on what's going on here, both, I guess, on the ground and in Moscow and Kiev? Is there a serious cause for concern?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously always the problem in that most times these things come to nothing much. And, you know, on the one hand, there are some people who precisely will always be saying, oh, my God, this is a sign that Russia intends to invade or similar. And others who say, no, it never happens. Well, but occasionally it does. So, yes, one always has to have a certain degree of caution and not be too positive. But nonetheless, I mean, if one looks at really what seems to have happened, I mean, Ukrainian forces went into the no man's land between the lines on to the village of Staromariivka. I mean, apparently escorting some aid shipments or whatever. Nonetheless, that was taken by the rebels as a sign of hostile intent. They shelled the Ukrainians. One of them died. In response, then the Ukrainians sent in their Bayraktar TB2 drone, destroyed this D-30 howitzer that had opened fire. And then in response to that, the Russians, you know, obviously sharpen their rhetoric, but also start moving some troops around because they know that always concentrates the mind wonderfully. Now, on one level, this sounds like an escalatory cycle. But on the other hand, frankly, this also has a certain sense of being, you know, the usual ritual. Everyone has to demonstrate their own strength, their own machismo, their own capacity and willingness to push back. And, you know, after a certain point, these things tend to dissipate. It's interesting. I was looking, for example, at the Russian press this morning, and there's very, very little about it. There was an initial flurry of reports, obviously, at the time of the attack. But, you know, there's nothing much there, even in, for example, Krasnaya Zvezda, the Russian army newspaper. So certainly there's not any signal there that sort of Moscow is trying to kind of prepare the ground for anything else. Instead, they're saying, oh, it's just that Zelensky needed to try and sort of, distract political opposition and also demonstrate his importance to the Western leadership. So, again, you know, however awkward and uncomfortable it makes me feel, because it sort of, you know, runs the risk that I could be very, very dangerously wrong on this. My sense is that neither Moscow nor Kyiv at the moment have any desire for a serious escalation. Of course, sometimes things aren't controlled or controllable. But it's also noteworthy that, you know, international partners seem to be trying to get this to be sort of played down. Right. You know, the Germans, for example, as I recall, issued a very sort of, I hesitate to say plague on both your houses, but, you know, encouraging both sides to de-escalate and so forth. The Turks, quite interestingly, have very much distanced themselves from the attack, more or less saying, well, once we sell the drone, it's absolutely nothing to do with us.
Right.
There isn't this sense that there is a sort of a strong sort of push from outside to encourage Ukraine to go further. So, you know, and I hope that by the end of this week, I have not been proven to be totally wrong. But I think this is just one of these things that will actually bubble down after a certain sort of usual exchange of unpleasant and acrimonious language.
Okay, well, that's very useful. We don't have too much time left, so I'd just like to ask one follow-up question about that or comment. There have been all these articles by Putin about Ukraine, one people, that sort of thing, and recently comments about red lines, and I think it was the Kremlin spokesman, Peskov, who was talking about, well, you know, Ukraine may not join NATO ever, but or in the near future, but, you know, that doesn't mean that NATO military infrastructure won't be developed in Ukraine, and that's like a red line for Russia. So that's the kind of thing I'm wondering, you know, is that sort of signaling about, well, you know, now we're going to have a lower threshold, that Russia's going to have a lower threshold for some sort of offensive, or is it just laying the groundwork for giving Putin himself options as he often does? So I guess that's or something else. I don't know if that question made sense, but the signaling from Russia about red lines, does it mark a change?
I'm not sure if it marks a change, because it's interesting, first of all, that we also had Peskov recently actually saying, well, you know, we can't stop Ukraine from joining NATO. Though obviously we would take steps to sort of minimize the security implications for us,
right,
which might have been a nudge towards something like sort of annexation of the Donbass or something like that. Who knows?
Right.
But more broadly, look, red lines, politicians love red lines. In practice, you know, red lines have a tendency to blur and fade in the sun. Yes, there's no question that from Russia's point of view, it would see any kind of extension of NATO security architecture into Ukraine, even without membership, as something extremely worrying, and in many ways actually playing to and seeming to justify precisely the same sort of paranoid rhetoric which actually was used to justify the annexation of Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, that said, I see absolutely no sign that NATO have any interest or desire to do that themselves. So there is an element in which actually sort of Russia gets to demonstrate that it's tough and willing to push back against the enemies of the motherland by basically saying you must not do something that almost certainly would not be happening in any case. I think from the Russians' point of view, well, from let's say from Putin's point of view, he's in something of an impasse. And again, you mentioned these lengthy and turgid historical articles that he writes. And, you know, it's a rather surreal experience to find a president of one of the sort of powerful nations of the world playing amateur historian, and a rather bad amateur historian at that. But it says something about the extent to which not only does he genuinely, I think of Ukraine as being some kind of sort of annex of Russia, historically, culturally, as well as politically and economically, but also that he's grappling with the dawning realization that in many ways it's precisely his actions which really have lost Ukraine to Russia. Even if they manage to Finlandize it and force it to be neutral or something like that, the Ukrainian people themselves are unlikely ever to look to Russia with the same kind of fellow feeling, almost sort of family feeling, that they once did. And Ukraine is now much more of a state than it has ever been. So I think, you know, for all these reasons, this is a really difficult issue for Russia's leaders to deal with, not just on a practical level, but also on a psychological level. And often that will kind of bubble out into this kind of intemperate language. But we shouldn't necessarily regard it as rigidly programmatic. They are not actually specifically saying, this is the flowchart, and if you do this, then we will do that.
Okay, absolutely. It sounds like, you know, more flailing around, I guess, and trying to deal with something that's already, I don't know, the train has left the station, I guess. All right, well, running out of time, we'll wrap it up there. Mark, thanks very much for joining me.
Oh, it's been my great pleasure.
All right, great to have you on the podcast. Okay, I'll be back next Monday, and please keep an eye out on Friday for my Week in Russia newsletter. Thanks for listening.